I'd like to call the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water into session.
To order.
And I would like to bring your attention to the agenda, if you have one, regarding public hearings. We're going to reverse the way we hear them this afternoon, and I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3595. And seeing no one in the room that wants to testify. Oh. If my good friend, Representative Huffman, would come forward, I would like to call on him first, because I understand you're doing this kind of thing in another room.
Oh, thank you, Chair Gilliam, committee. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to hear House Bill 3595. I can't wait to get the bill for what this hearing's going to cost me, but we'll deal with that later. I thought it was really appropriate that we talk about solar on a particularly wonderful weather day in Salem. Might brighten everything up and cheer everybody. I've got a few people behind me that are going to speak on this today, and they have a really cool PowerPoint that I want everybody to pay attention to. It's got some great pictures of the type of land that we're really talking about. But again, I just want to thank you for giving us the time to present this today. John Skidmore, the planner from Jefferson County, is going to be here speaking. And I hope John will bring up the group of people that we've had meeting this past year in trying to work out the right language on solar farm placement and other great things surrounding solar farms and economic development. And so with that, I will shut up and let the people that really know what they're talking about come up here before the chair gavels me down and says, get out of here.
I would never do that, but why don't you get out of here?
Thank you.
No, anybody for our colleague before he goes. All right, you're off the hook. Thank you, Representative. Okay, we're going to keep things moving, and I'd like to call, boy, I wonder if this is who I think it is, Cliff Schrock. Nope. I know another Cliff Schrock. Todd Gregory and John Skidmore, if they would. Please come to the dais, and if you identify yourself for the record, and I'm going to ask you, if you can, don't read his testimony, although we are very happy to get any written testimony copies of, and we'll distribute it to the committee. If you can give us the highlights, we'll try to get through this, because the second bill that we're hearing has even more folks. So welcome, and we'd love to hear what you have to say.
Yes, and here lies the issue with being the first guy in the room and putting his name on the list. My name's Cliff Schrock. I work for a large electrical contractor as a solar engineer, and I also do some development of solar sites. I came to testify actually on the other bill and finally understood this one, and it appears to be a clarification, adding the word photovoltaic largely. I'd always assumed that was already covered under the bill, but this obviously clarifies it, so I'm in favor. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Now, I neglected to ask Liz if she would give us the summary, just so that everybody's got a context, and we'll just take a second to do that if you'll help us out. Liz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3595 would authorize county governments or their designees to approve siting of solar energy generation facilities on land that is zoned for exclusive farm use, so long as that land is not high-value farmland and so long as the facility does not require a site certificate.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Gregory.
We're going to let John go first.
Okay. Or if it's okay, I'll testify. My name is John Skidmore. I'm the planning director for Jefferson County. County seat is Madras, Central Oregon. And here to testify in support of House Bill 3595, as Representative Huffman mentioned, we've been looking at this this solar farm issue for quite a while in Central Oregon. Central Oregon has a lot of sun. A lot of land, which makes it a viable area to site these solar farms. However, what I did with our economic development manager was sit down and do a dry run permitting process for a solar farm, call it 5-10 miles east of Madras. And what we ran into real quickly was what's become known as the 12-20 rule. And our Goal 3 protections permit solar farms or energy production facilities on EFU land up to a 12-acre limit on high-value farmland and a 20-acre limit on non-high-value. We're really focused on the non-high-value, this 20-acre limit. In terms of the solar farm world, it takes about 7.5 to 10 acres per megawatt, so a 20-acre facility really doesn't pencil too well. It's really not worth the time and effort to develop it. And you can exceed those limits if you go through a Goal 3 exception, which in the land use world is a very, very complicated, subjective process. And what I've found in speaking with a number of developers, it's been a deterrent. As one gentleman put it, you know, I can't do a cost-benefit analysis on a Goal 3 exception because you don't have a set of rules and standards that I need to meet. It's really kind of a moving target as you go through the Goal 3 exceptions. So what this bill would do would be to remove that Goal 3 exception and the 20-acre limit on non-high-value farmlands. In Jefferson County, I've got about 500,000 acres that are protected by Goal 3 but don't have any irrigation. So really, you can't be using them for true agricultural purposes. This gives those large property owners and farmers another resource use of this marginal resource land. So, you know, you'd have areas that really aren't ripe for farming but might be very ripe for solar farms. Further, this bill wouldn't erode farmland protections. These proposals would be very locational specific. You need to be close to transmission lines. You need to be close to substations. These solar farms don't produce the amount of energy that would allow you to string miles of transmission line. At $500,000 a mile, that really limits where these things are going to go. So it's self-selective. We're looking specifically at non-high-value farmland, so that's going to limit it even further. Again, we want to protect high-value farmland. We understand the value of that, but low-value, we want to open up some options for the farmers. And then we also still require a local conditional use review. So there's still a review at the local level where there's public input and where these debates can be held locally. What I think this really would do is it levels the playing field by providing certainty in the review process. And I think as a state, you know, with EFU land and farmers, we've really spent a lot of time limiting the abilities for these folks to use their lands for economic uses. We limit the ability for them to use them for wineries, for vineyards. We limit the amount of weddings they can have and these types of things. I think this is a real positive change that we're going to provide yet another resource use for these folks who happen to have marginal resource land. And so I guess in summary, this bill is good for the environment, it's good for the farmers, and it's good for Oregon, and I hope you support it. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a good summary. Please.
Good afternoon, Chairs Cannon and Gilliam, committee. My name is Todd Gregory. I'm the Assistant Vice President at Obsidian Finance Group in Portland, Oregon. Obsidian, through its subsidiaries, Obsidian Renewables, we're developing medium-scale utility-scale solar facilities in eastern and southern, southeastern Oregon. And we support House Bill 3595 and large-scale solar development. I'd like to offer five points for the committee to think about today. First, a significant amount of land in central and eastern Oregon zoned agriculture, including EFU land, is in fact non-resource land. If you look at your pictures there, that's the type of land that we're talking about as far as being the type of land that we're chasing to have a more streamlined process. You'll see it's mostly sagebrush. Some of the land is, type of, it could be, better land, but without irrigation. So it's not land that that would support a commercial agricultural enterprise. However, renewable energy development should be allowed on non-resource land regardless of zoning classifications without having to go through an onerous, duplicative state Goal 3 exception process, as Mr. Skidmore is describing next to me. True non-high-value land contributes little to the state's agricultural economy and will not support a commercial agricultural enterprise. As you can see from the pictures, it looks like pretty you know, pretty barren type of land. And again, that's the kind of land we're chasing after. Many counties do not have a zoning code for non-resource zoning. It simply defaults to an agricultural, you know, they zone it A2, and that's kind of their default zoning for everything that would be normally considered non-resource zoning. There are a few counties that have a non-resource code, but not many. However, the non-high-value land is available for renewable energy development without the need to satisfy a Goal 3 exception process. The counties already have a comprehensive process with the conditional use permit process that developers have to go through currently, and you know, that balances the merits and concerns over siting solar facilities on non-high-value land. In order to attract renewable energy development, the counties need to have the ultimate authority to make decisions about whether or not to site solar facilities on marginal lands within their respective counties. Second point, and I'll hurry up. Marginally productive farmland that cannot support a commercially agricultural enterprise, again, has a great renewable energy development potential, and it's good policy for such lands to be available for renewable energy development. A Goal 3 exception process is not necessary in this process. The purpose of Goal 3 is to protect the state's valuable agricultural economy and keep productive farmland in productive use. Marginally productive farmland is often closely associated with productive farmland because of its proximity. It's close to it. However, many of the large farms, ranches, you know, in eastern Oregon, they'll have rough patches of 100 acres, 200 acres, where it might be rocky or they don't have irrigation rights, can't get irrigation rights because of water moratoriums, or it could be alkali, you know, soil and so forth. These types of rough patches don't support a commercial agricultural enterprise and should be allowed to be used for renewable energy, which is the best economic use for marginally productive farmland. Third point, renewable energy development is consistent with the goals of a long-term, sustainable, healthy agricultural resource economy. The rules and policies of the state should support integration of renewable energy into rural agricultural practices. We're already seeing some of that in Klamath County, where folks are putting solar up to power cold storage. We're seeing it to run irrigation, especially down in the Klamath area, where they're going to have to start paying a lot more for power with the dam removals and so forth. This is just the next step in that direction. Number four, in order to compete with other states, Oregon needs to streamline the land use process for utility-scale solar development on marginal lands, and this bill provides that vehicle to do that. The near-term market for solar power projects is for projects in the 20 to 50 megawatt range. We believe it's going to go, and most of industry believes that you know, it's going to go from 5-megawatt type size facilities to 20 to, you know, 50 megawatt type size facilities. As far as acreage is concerned, that basically means 150 to 450 acres, the rough figures. Developers are allowed to efficiently build projects in this size range, they'll be able to take advantage of short-term federal incentives and economies of scale, and they will not need state tax incentives like the Betsy to support the projects. And I think that bears the saying again, if we're allowed to streamline the process, build projects on larger parcels, the economies of scale that we can accomplish, by doing so, will eliminate the need for state tax subsidies on these projects. However, if Oregon remains one of the most difficult states in the western United States to site solar projects, and there is not a state incentive or something to support the extra cost of the onerous land use process, developers will seek out better opportunities in Oregon's neighboring states. And my fifth and final point goes to, it's kind of a technical point, but it's an important point. A solar photovoltaic facility is very different from a solar collecting and solar thermal facility, and our land use law should reflect the different impacts related to the different types of technologies in the solar industry. This bill accomplishes that through clarifying the language in 469-300. The difference is solar collecting facilities typically use mirrors or other reflective devices to boil water or other types of fluid, like molten salt, for example. They require substantial amounts of water for both steam and cooling, and they produce great amounts of heat. And they're basically a big, they turn steam generators just like a natural gas facility would do. It's a big industrial type of process. So it's a type of process that it makes a lot of sense to take a look at an acreage threshold or a physical size footprint before a state agency would take a second look at it. Solar photovoltaic facilities simply convert sunlight into energy. These are three major components to a solar PV facility. There's solar panels, inverters, and racking. It's that simple. In fact, nothing on our sites that we're currently getting ready to build is over 8 feet tall. Just by way of example. Solar PV projects do not require water. They don't have to, collect the heat. There's no steam generation turbines, no cooling towers, no cooling ponds, or other industrial processes. They're simply panels that sit in the desert. They don't carry as much impact to the land as solar thermal projects. As such, solar PV facilities should be regulated with respect to a capacity threshold, similar to what wind has now, and not by reference to a physical footprint. HB 3595 recognizes the technology and land use differences apparent in the solar industry. I'd like to thank you for your time.
Thank you. Do we have questions for this panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following on your last point, will you explain precisely how this proposes to change the trigger for the site certificate, the FSEC requirement? So there's currently a standard above which a solar project like the one you're describing would require a site certificate. You're proposing to change that. Can you tell us about what the standard is now and what it would be under this bill?
Co-Chair Cannon, the... Among industry folks, like other developers, we believe that the current reading of the current law can be interpreted to exactly what we're describing here, whereas solar PV would have a megawatt type threshold because it mentions solar in several aspects of the state without reference to solar collecting facilities, whereas solar collecting facilities are only referenced with the 100-acre threshold. Now, realizing that one has never been cited in the state, so there are different interpretations to that rule, and in speaking with legislative counsel, they thought that it definitely needed some clarification because it could be interpreted in many different ways. The way that we are interpreting it with these language clarifications is that a solar thermal type of facility, like the pictures that you're seeing on the pictures with the big Stirling dishes, troughs, towers, mirrors, the industrial type processes, nothing would change. It would still have a 100-acre threshold before FSEC, they'd need an FSEC siting certificate. However, for solar photovoltaic, we just inserted the word photovoltaic in front of solar to clarify that that's what it means. So it would be a threshold that's the same as wind, which is 35 average megawatts, which in acreage terms, the maximum capacity would be roughly 700 acres. Okay. And with the changes in efficiency, cost of panels, and so forth, that's going to be coming down over the years.
Thank you.
Other questions?
If not, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate the testimony. Thank you.
I think I'd like to call, is it Aldrich, Elaine Aldrich? I got that right? And if Sue Marshall and Pam Hardy would come up as well, please. Please.
Good afternoon. My name is Elaine Aldrich. I'm an attorney at Stoll Reeves in Portland, and I'm attending here on behalf of Element Power, who is a Portland-based renewable energy developer focusing on utility-scale wind and solar development. I'm here to provide testimony with respect to Sections 1 and 2 of House Bill 3595 in support of the bill. We strongly encourage the committee to recommend this forward. I have been working with Element Power for over the past year on trying to permit a utility-scale solar facility in Lake County. Our project has been is required to obtain a Goal 3 exception as well as a conditional use permit. This means that really we are going through two discretionary subjective land use processes that present a variety of opportunities for opponents to oppose the project as well as appeal the project, both at a local level up through the Board of County Commissioners and then to the Land Use Board of Appeals and potentially up through the Court of Appeals. So this two discretionary review processes creates intense uncertainty for developers. It requires intensive legal and technical resources, and as Element Power is realizing, is very, very cost intensive to the point of almost being cost prohibitive. With that context in mind, Element is a participant on the current LCDC's Rural Advisory Committee. LCDC, recognizing the focus on the potential for solar development in Oregon, formed the RAC. It was established in September 2010 and has been meeting since then. Element, as a member of the RAC, has been trying to work with other committee members to devise a rule amendment language that would create an exception to the Goal 3 process for certain types of solar facilities on agricultural lands. While the committee has made some progress, and the latest draft of the proposed Goal 3 amendment is a step in the right direction, it does not go far enough to give developers a clear direction of where to site on lands in Oregon. Element believes that the state should encourage and incentivize the siting of solar projects on non-high-value farmland soils on these larger parcels. House Bill 3595 does just that. It goes farther than the proposed LCDC rule language and makes it perfectly clear to developers that the state is encouraging siting on non-high-value farmland soils. I think as background, it should be noted that farmland soils are not the only factors that developers consider when selecting a site for a solar project in Oregon. The site selection process is intense, and it includes a variety of factors that must be equally considered. Those factors are access and proximity to transmission lines of appropriate voltage and associated substations, environmental considerations, land control and parcel size, grade of the land itself, zoning, and then, of course, the available solar resource. Developers engage in a balancing act when considering these variety of factors to see if a project is actually going to be viable. And if the numbers don't work out, then the project site is actually abandoned. What we're seeing with this two-step discretionary land use review process and with the proposed draft LCDC rule is a continuing layer of regulatory requirements that are adding to this factors list that ultimately gets into the balancing act. And it's questionable whether we're actually going to see continued solar development in Oregon unless some of these requirements are reduced. House Bill 3595 streamlines the current permitting process and would obviate the need for Goal 3 exception on non-high-value farmland soils, which is appropriate given the nature of solar development. I think it's important to consider that solar development, unlike some traditional energy development, is less intense of land, meaning you don't need to extend public services, you're not needing to extend water, sewer, there's very little need for road improvements, transportation impacts are minimal once the facility is operating given the nature of the operations. It has been found throughout conditional use processes that this use is compatible with agricultural activities on adjacent farmlands. That I would say is found by county findings in existing conditional use permits. And I think finally, in the kind of the importance of this bill and looking at what the purpose of Goal 3 is really about, is that this bill and these types of projects do not pose a risk to the agricultural economy of the state. I think, in contrast, these projects actually assist farmers. They allow farmers to put into, quote, production less productive lands by allowing them to lease these properties for solar development and using that income from those lease payments in order to make improvements and benefit operations on their more productive farmlands. So in that way, it continues to promote agricultural economy in our communities. And I think finally, something to note is that House Bill 3595 does not eliminate the conditional use process. Instead, it gives jurisdiction to the counties to adopt or revise conditional use criteria to govern the siting of solar facilities on non-high-value farmland soils. And in closing, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have about the current regulatory framework, Element Power's project or experiences that they've had in the state. And again, thank you for your time and encourage your support of House Bill 3595.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll hold questions for this panel till we're through. We're going to shift gears a little bit, I think. And Sue, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here on behalf of Liz Nyson and the Oregon Natural Desert Association to speak about their concerns for House Bill 3595. ONDA is a nonprofit conservation organization headquartered in Bend with offices in Portland and Ontario. We strive to protect, defend, and restore Oregon's high desert environment, and we represent over 1,500 members throughout Oregon. We support responsible renewable energy development and believe renewable energy is compatible with our mission to ensure long-term protection of our high desert resources. One way we feel we can promote responsible energy generation is by advocating for policies that guarantee projects are sited, permitted, and developed in a way that is compatible with our natural environment. ONDA strongly opposes passage of HB 3595 and believe it would critically alter Oregon's high desert region. The goal of the bill is to expand for photovoltaic solar and eliminate acreage thresholds which currently exist. While we support solar technologies, ONDA believes this bill would cause additional community conflict, create barriers to wildlife movement, and fundamentally change the character of the eastern Oregon landscapes. Right now, the proposed solar facilities with a footprint of 100 acres or more are required to seek site certification from FSEC. This bill would eliminate the acreage limit for photovoltaic solar and instead rely on megawatt thresholds similar to wind. This means that a project just under the threshold of 104 megawatts peak generating capacity with a footprint of over 700 acres would not have to go through the Energy Facility Siting Council for site certification. Instead, the developers could seek a conditional use permit from the county. In bypassing the state permitting process, these large projects will circumvent review by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, other state agencies, and require less input, public input. The Oregon legislature created a bifurcated permitting process for energy siting for a reason. Big projects were intended to go to FSEC. Smaller projects were allowed to go through the county conditional use and local planning authorities. Passage of the bill would fundamentally change the original intent of the legislature and potentially create new conflicts. And we ask that you not support this bill and very much appreciate your time. I personally may not be able to answer your questions, but I would be happy to take them and consult with my client to get you answers.
I had quite a long list for you, but I guess...
I thought that you might.
All right. Pam, please.
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, thank you so much for having us here today. I also thought of the irony as I was leaving Bend in a pouring downpour about testifying on solar on such a day. Most of our days over in eastern Oregon are beautiful sunny days, and that actually goes to one of my main points. In eastern Oregon, we have a lot of sun. It's great. There's a lot of wonderful things about it, but one of the things that means is that we can actually afford to be a little bit choosy about exactly where we put our solar panels. My name is Pam Hardy. I represent Thousand Friends of Oregon. I'm their staff attorney and Central Oregon advocate. And I've come all the way over here because I actually sat on the LCDC Solar Advisory Council and worked with Nicole Hughes of Element Power and several other people to try and come up with language that really incentivized the placement of large-scale solar panels and solar farms on our least productive agricultural land and on our least important wildlife habitat. We have a lot of sun in eastern Oregon, but some of these other resources are a little more limited. The problem with this bill is that essentially what it does is it opens up all of this land. And while it does accept the highest value farmland, in eastern Oregon, we have very little technically high-value farmland. A lot of our farmland is not as good, but I talk to farmers and ranchers all the time who are making a very good living on Class 6 soils. It's rather astonishing, but that's what they're doing. And in Christmas Valley, where a lot of these are going in, they're even exporting hay to other states, and I even understand that some of those folks are even exporting hay to China, which, frankly, when I heard that, I said, what? How can that be possible? But we have, in some places, we have high-quality agricultural soils over there. Thousand Friends fully supports that we need a lot of solar in this state. We just need a law that incentivizes the placement of that solar so that it doesn't take over an existing good industry. Agriculture is a very important industry to the state of Oregon. It's a very important industry in eastern Oregon. And what we need to do here is figure out a way to create incentives in the law so that solar developers think very carefully about how to find locations that actually have the least important agricultural resources, places that are not being used, or places that were tried and abandoned because the soil was not good. Those are the ideal places. Solar is also going to have an enormous impact on wildlife. Right now in eastern Oregon, we have a big problem with sage grouse. Sage grouse was recently determined by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to be warranted for listing as an endangered species, but it's not listed yet. There's effort in eastern Oregon right now to rally the forces to get everyone together to try and avoid a listing, because if it is listed, it's going to be a big problem. Unfortunately, these very large solar developments could well have the effect of eliminating sage grouse and other wildlife habitats. Solar developments, by their nature, from what I understand from developers, and maybe Elaine can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but from what I understand from developers, they absolutely must be fenced. And they must be fenced well enough that they can keep people out. And the reason for that is to avoid vandalism. What we're talking about here is expanding the footprint of a solar development from a maximum of 100 acres before it goes through state siting to somewhere around 700 or maybe even 800 acres before it goes through a state siting that actually considers things like wildlife. 640 acres is a square mile. So we're talking about solar developments that are over a square mile potentially that are going to have virtually no wildlife review. Our Goal 5 laws had a good idea originally, but they're not as good at dealing with emerging conflicts and emerging resources that we had just simply never thought about 20 years ago when we did the inventories. What we need to do now is figure out a way to write this law so that we can create incentives for solar developers to look for the places that are the least important agriculturally and the least important in terms of wildlife. We have a lot of acreage out there. There's got to be the land out there. This bill is a good one. In terms of opening up solar development, it's a bad one in terms of taking the nuanced approach that really needs to be taken. In the LCDC Advisory Council, we were a long ways down the road in terms of finding a solution that was going to incentivize placement and lower the barriers, the regulatory barriers, on the least important lands and raise the barriers, or not raise them, but just keep them essentially where they are, on the most valuable land. We came up with another distinction of farmland, arable farmland and non-arable farmland, to talk about farmlands in eastern Oregon, just because high value is just a different word. And finally, I'd like to speak a little bit about our comparison with other states. Curiously, down in California, solar developers are rushing to the public lands to try and get all of their solar placed on the public lands, despite the fact that they have to go through rather extensive environmental review on the public lands down there. They are not rushing to the private lands because the private lands are more complex of a regulatory process to go through than even the public lands. Here in Oregon, we're witnessing the exact opposite. The solar developers are going to the private lands because the private lands are actually easier to permit on than the public lands, even though they have all of the staff experience in how to site on federal public lands in California. Here in Oregon, they're going for the private lands because it's already easier. It's already easier. And this law would only open up that possibility and make it even easier. Finally, I do need to speak a little bit to the farmers and the farmers' experience. I have just spoken with so many farmers from the Christmas Valley area. There are communities that are going to welcome this, and there are communities that really want to be left alone. I think there's a way to draw up a law that would make it so that the communities themselves have a little bit more of a say in where this gets cited. Elaine spoke eloquently about the frustrations of the appeals going on with solar. If we cite solar at over a square mile, we're going to have the same kind of backlash as we're having about wind. Let's figure out a way to draw up a law that cites solar in the places where the communities actually welcome them, rather than in the places where the communities are going to be up in arms about it and we're going to see another backlash. This has to be possible. We were very close to doing that in the LCDC Rulemaking Advisory Council. I hope that you'll oppose this bill and let that advisory council go forward and complete the work that it began.
Other questions for this panel?
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to find out the number of acres that are over in my part of the world, and I note that this Baker-Malheur Union Wallowa counties with over 5 million acres of federal range, 5 million acres of federal range. We have lots of space. I think my district is 26,000 square miles, and of that, probably 80% is public. And that land, people aren't putting projects on it because the permitting process takes far too long. Many times it's impossible. And so this bill suggests that there might be a square mile of these units that would be 640 acres.
640, correct.
And so it strikes me that since 80% of my district is already a park, the other 20% can probably be utilized for something that actually does make Oregon a little more energy independent. The conditional use process, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think I just saw it in the attorney's materials, does require a hearing, and seems to me that folks in the community would have an opportunity to appear and oppose the grant of the conditional use. Is that something that I'm hearing you folks would fear? Is that what you're worried about, that the local county would have the say over it and you fear the outcome?
No, we don't fear the outcome of that, because local people should have control over their local land use decisions. What we're concerned about is that there are, when you're talking about impacts that are as enormous as we're talking about, that there are state level concerns that need to be addressed, particularly things like wildlife and essentially the obliteration of agricultural lands underneath those solar developments, if that's where they're placed. And I just got an email moments before I walked out of the office that said almost the same thing you did. And it was from a farmer that I've been in communication with out in Christmas Valley. And she said, we have 8,100 acres around here. There's got to be somewhere that we can find to put these panels where there's not going to be a conflict. And so we absolutely agree that there's got to be somewhere that we can put these panels. It's just a question of creating incentives in the law so that they're put in better places, so that the solar developers look for the places that are not in conflict. That's all we're asking.
Follow up.
Please.
Thank you. If I recall correctly, we're in the process of closing down the coal-fired plant in Boardman, 600 megawatts. We need to replace that relatively quickly. The process that you're suggesting will take quite a bit more time. I'm assuming that time isn't part of your concern, given the additional time it would take to site these under your approach. Am I correct?
No. And here's why. You're very close. You're not far off, but here's the reason that the answer is no. The rules that we came up with in the Solar Advisory Council, and I would be happy, you know, our last draft was not entirely completed. It made the siting on places that were low wildlife habitat and low productive agriculture very, very easy, virtually an outright permit, barely even, not even a conditional use. And then it stepped up the requirements as it became more and more productive agriculture and more important wildlife requirements. So what it did was it incentivized location of these solar developments in the places that were actually already determined to have the least conflicts. And that was the goal. So I don't believe that it would take more time. I believe that, in fact, it could be done in exactly the same amount of time.
Well,
sure.
It's probably adequate that we agree to disagree. It strikes me that the good farm land in Eastern Oregon is not going to be placed under systems of this nature because we have far too much bad farmland. And anyone with 8,000 acres is going to have lots of acreage that lends itself to this type of development, and that which can be used for something else, they'll use for something else. So this is an indication of how we in Oregon seem to think that we have all the time in the world to generate green electricity, and we don't. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me say that.
You're welcome, Representative. Other comments or questions? Well, thank you to the panel. And Pam, I appreciate you coming over. I don't appreciate you reminding us how much better your weather is, but we appreciate you coming.
So, well, it sure would be more convenient if you guys just decided to move to Capitol Bend.
Okay, fine. We'll take it under consideration. And I'd like to call up our last panel, Brian Krieg, Glenn Montgomery, and Michael Morrissey. And Brian, you got here first, so if you'd identify yourself, we welcome your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Gilliam. For the record, Brian Krieg, today representing the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers, the IBW workers in Oregon. We're here to support the bill. We think it will help rural Oregon. It'll help create jobs, and it'll add safe energy resources that are vitally needed for this state. Thank you.
Very well done. We should have Representative Gilliam leave the room more often.
Co-Chair Cannon, it's not the panel that's the problem.
Mr. Montgomery.
For the record, my name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. We are the trade group that represents solar manufacturers, installers, developers, nonprofits, public education institutions, etc. I am here to testify in support of House Bill 3595 because I believe it is a common sense bill. I'm not going to go through all of my points in my written testimony. You should have that in your packet. But what we're asking for, and I think what this bill sets out to achieve and does so does so very well, is allow local control over the siting of solar facilities. And we're not removing that control. The conditional use permit is a vehicle that is in place. What we are doing is eliminating the added barrier, the onerous process of yet another discretionary review that is currently in place and interpreted as such with the current legislation. In particular, our rural economies, our rural property landowners need some flexibility. They need choices. I don't think we are going to, if this legislation passes, I don't think we are going to see rural Oregon blanketed with photovoltaic panels in the next 6 months. That's not going to occur. But what we will see are landowners being able to explore opportunities and not being deterred by a discretionary review that elongates the process of siting and permitting, creates so much more cost and complexity to the project that no one is willing to even explore the opportunity. Our rural folk, this is one of those issues that I think both rural and urban folk are behind. It's generating renewable energy is good for our environment, good for our economy, good for our communities. We just want to give control back to the counties, use the conditional use permit as it exists today to control any kind of sprawling development of photovoltaics and to place it where it makes sense. I'm going to leave my comments at that. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Gilliam and Cannon and committee members, I'm Michael Morrissey. I'm a policy analyst with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. We're neutral on this bill. I'm here in part to verify that we have had and do have a rules advisory committee that operated roughly from December through late February. The committee's largely done with its work and is prepared to forward a recommendation to the commission. I would say that the committee members, of which you've heard some representation about, voted to pass along this recommendation to the commission. There's not unanimity on all the aspects of the bill, but I would say from their vote, the committee indicated a willingness to forward what they had done so far to the commission. You've heard about the 1220 rule, so I won't go over that again, but our rulemaking committee, that's the focus, and that was the impetus for the rulemaking committee in the first place. And in fact, Eastern Oregon interests, particularly Jefferson County, and I believe some representatives of the solar rulemaking committee did come and ask the commission to carry out this rulemaking, and the commission instructed the department to do so. The committee's met four times and, frankly, has gone over a lot of the territory that you've heard and maybe even more. Two of the bigger issues had to do with what types of land were appropriate for siting and to take out of farm use. Another large issue was how to address issues of fish and wildlife habitat that might be impacted by, at that point, what was considered fairly large development, up to 100 acres. I would say that the committee had some discussion of up to 104 megawatts, but did not discuss anything as large as 800 acres or 700 acres. So that wasn't, to this point, part of their discussion. So I think I'm going to stop at that point. I'm glad to answer questions. I'm not here really to defend the tentative recommendations of the committee per se or get into any of that. I'm just here to say it's our rules that are involved here, and we've been working on them.
Thank you. Vice Chair Krieger.
Appears to be it's one of those things, it's a great idea, but not in my backyard. The other thing I wanted you to address was the role of having the transmission capacity from where those sites are, because I would say in most of those rural areas, and if it's private property, even out in Eastern Oregon, you got a pretty small line going to the individual property. So what would be the capacity to do that economically?
Chair Gilliam, Representative Krieger, members of the committee, I think, as was alluded to by the young woman from Stoll Reeves, a developer, as part of the analysis, has to go through a checklist, if you will, of those things that they're going to need to have in place before they can do a green light on a project. And some of those include access to transmission lines, the substations to make sure they've got adequate voltage, et cetera. So already, we would have some limitations in place. Private landowners, depending on where they are in parts of Oregon, some will win and some will lose, so to speak, in terms of where the existing infrastructure resides. So I think we would tend to see projects happening along those existing transmission lines where they can tie in, and projects that aren't would have a much more difficult time getting a green light. So I hope that answers your question.
It does, yeah.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? If not, thank you for coming. Appreciate your testimony. And I'm just before I close this, I'm going to mention, especially to my co-chair, that I, among the other issues that were brought up, I'm interested in talking more about the definition of what is not prime agricultural land, because when you trace it back, Liz has been helping me, it's a long definition in rule, but there's very little in statute, and I'm not going to say worried, but I'm interested in a better definition. So we will continue to discuss this, but for now, Representative Witt has something, and I want to make sure he has a chance to say something.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would also be interested in the potential overlay of FERC regulatory capacity in this process as well.
Thank you, Representative. You're right. So with that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3595, and I'd like to open the first public hearing on House Bill 3516. And as I call up the first panel, it'll be Lisa Nato, Mark Pengilly, and Anna Schoberg. My colleague, Representative Bailey, might have a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Please feel free to come on up.
I had intended to kick off the panel testifying in favor of the bill. I will spare the committee in the interest of time. But it's a good bill, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative.
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3516. Mr. Free has set the standard for efficiency and speed in testifying, and I don't think I can match the standard he has set. But I appreciate Representative Benson's comment that we don't have all the time in the world to transition to renewable energy. And so House Bill 3516 is one of the practical steps that we can take to facilitate that transition. As you know from the written materials, this bill is intended to address two problems that have arisen from the installation of small-scale solar projects on rooftops. In the 2009 session, I worked with Oregonians for Renewable Energy Policy and with Lisa Nato to implement a feed-in tariff system of solar incentives in Oregon. The result was House Bill 3039, which resulted in the Solar Incentive Pilot Program, where small independent producers are paid by the utilities for the energy they generate and feed back.
Mark, I'm going to interrupt just for a minute. Would you identify for the record? Sorry.
I'm sorry, Chair Gilley. Mark Pengilly for the record. That was forward-looking policy, but unanticipated problems have been encountered by would-be installers under the program. The first is that in some zones, applicants have been told by local land use planners that while their systems would have been permitted if they were net metered and the power was used on site, since it appeared they would be selling electricity back to the grid, their permits would be denied, because selling electricity was not on the list of uses in that zone. The panels are the same. The wiring is the same. This would seem to be a distinction without a without a difference. So the bill seeks to make it clear that in all zones of the state where there are existing legal structures and where the proposed solar installation does not exceed the height of the structure or the footprint of the structure, it's not a land use decision whether that system can be installed. We still want these systems to comply with structural standards and be safe electrically, but they should not rise to the level of a land use decision. I also detailed in the written materials my own difficulties installing solar panels in an environmental overlay zone, and I won't reiterate all of those difficulties for you here, but suffice it to say that it seemed to make no sense to me where the structure itself was not visible and these panels were mounted flat on the roof that this would rise to the level of a land use review and that there would be months of delay and fees which would cause a financial hardship to the applicant and essentially destroy the anticipated economics of the system. We've since learned that this has a broader application beyond just the environmental overlay zones and the zones where there's a confusion about selling electricity to the conservation zones in the city of Portland. There also would-be installers of solar systems have been told that they could not do this because they're unbeknownst to them, when they had bought the property, these systems were not allowed. Although in those same zones, satellite dishes were allowed, skylights could be installed, siding could be put on the houses, but not solar systems. Representative Krieger mentioned the not in my backyard scenario. I think what we have here is a please on my roof situation. It's usually when you put in infrastructure, nobody wants it in his or her backyard. Here you have the situation where people are saying, please let me put this renewable infrastructure on my roof, and the local zoning codes are posing an obstacle to that. I urge you to support House Bill 3516, and I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Lisa, please.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon. I'm Lisa Nato, and I've had a few titles, but today the one I'm most proud of is that I'm a former member of this Energy and Environment Committee in the House. And I want to thank you all for the important work you are doing in your public service. I support House Bill 3516. I support renewable energy, and I think this bill, and the word common sense is being used a lot, but I think it is a common sense bill that makes some changes just to make it easier and then more economical for people to put solar panels on their rooftops. We agree that it's important to give local governments the ability to maintain health and safety standards through their building code process. However, the installation of solar panels on rooftops of existing buildings or allowed construction, in our view, does not rise to the level of a land use or zoning matter. We support the Dash 1 amendments to clarify that this, the intent of the bill is to be on the structures themselves, not on adjacent to the structures. And we also have learned about concerns from cities about federally designated historic districts, so we would not object, although we would hope cities would adopt regulations that would make it easier and have an affordable cost to putting panels even in historic districts. I do want to acknowledge the work of Christy Splitt in Representative Cannon, Co-Chair Cannon's office, and the work she has done and the assistance she has provided to us. And I thank you for your attention today.
We all like Christy. Christy's in the room, too.
Oh, if I might, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair. Bob Repine, who I served with in the House, is the acting director of the Oregon Department of Energy and was here to testify but did have a conflict and asked that I represent to the committee that he supports the bill with the amendments we proposed and will submit written testimony to the committee.
Thank you. I'm sorry we didn't get him up here, but thank you for submitting that. Kathleen.
Hi, thank you, Chair Gilliam and Chair Cannon. I apologize, it's my first time doing this, but my name is Anna Schoberg, and I'm coming as a citizen, as a residential homeowner. And I kind of just want to tell a brief summary of our story, what our scenarios and what we found out is happening to other people in our community. My husband and I bought our first home in June 2009. And prior to buying a home, we knew that we wanted to install solar panels on the house, so we did a very diligent home search. We actually looked at over 100 homes in Portland, so we're very committed to having that option on our home. We started to consider getting solar in 2010 when the Solarize Northeast program started. We actually live just slightly in North Portland, but they had opened registration to people in other districts in Portland. Combined with our solar panels, we wanted to get weather efficiency done to our house. We had insulation put in. We wanted to get all those updates done prior. We attended all the Solarize Portland meetings. We talked with the Energy Trust, and we had three bids on our house from three different solar contractors, all telling us what an optimum place we have to have solar panels, with an energy review saying that we could save up to 50% on our energy bill and cutting our gas by 30% with our weatherization upgrades. So in September, when our weatherization upgrades were done, we started moving forward. We had already paid our 50% deposit for our solar panels, and then we were informed in mid-October that our house was not eligible for solar arrays because we live in a conservation district. And granted, this may be naive, but after going through all of this search, going to find a house, we didn't even know what a conservation district was. Our house is non-historic. It's a non-contributing house. And in our neighborhood, there's already existing solar panels on homes we later found out are in the conservation district. The city of Portland had recap 5 in April 2010 that changed this to be more restrictive, or which they were not saying restrictive, but more a more aligned policy, I guess that's what I should say. So we found out at that point, they said we could go through a historic design review, but then we were told that our house was actually forbidden to pass the design review, not even to submit it, because we have street-facing solar panels. So our house is ineligible completely in current standards in Portland. So I'm here today to speak in support for Bill 3516 as a homeowner, as a member of the community, and in the neighborhood that we live in. We're very passionate that this is something that's better for our communities, not worse for our communities, particularly in conservation districts where we're not on a National Historic Registry nor on a State Historic Registry, and it's just city implemented. And that's, I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Anna. I'm sorry I called you by the wrong name. I jumped down on that.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for coming. What neighborhood are you in Portland?
I live in Piedmont Conservation District.
Okay. And I want to thank all three of you for testifying. Are there any questions for this panel? If not, we'll go to the next one. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And it's not my intent to divide families. So if Daniel Schoberg wants to come, he's welcome to do so.
Conservation District is awesome.
And Kathleen Papala and Clifford Schrock again.
It must be a Democrat conspiracy.
Did we get the story told, Daniel? Are we okay?
Yeah.
We allow it. I wouldn't be able to.
All right. Good. Thank you for coming. And I've got you on here twice, right, Clifford?
Yes.
And Pam Hardy again, please. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair Cannon and Co-Chair Gillian and the committee. This is also my first time testifying, so a little nervous. Excuse that.
You're doing fine.
I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Kathleen Hoppala. I'm a Portland resident. I also am in a conservation district, which is not to be confused with a historic district. I am here in support of House Bill 3516. And I'd like to briefly share my story of my experience in trying to install solar PVs on my roof in 2010 as part of Solarize Northeast. After the contractor, which was Solar City at the time, did an initial survey and initial design of my property, I was also informed that I had two choices in pursuing solar. One choice was to do a 10-panel system on the back of my roof, which would require me to go through historic design review. My second option was to go through a prescriptive path, which is called community design standards in the zoning code. But that would require me to follow additional standards, including greater setbacks from the roof edge. So if I were to do that, then my 10-panel system would be reduced to 6 panels. My family decided that we would go ahead and do that, that we would go ahead and downsize our system, work with the 6-panel system, which would be 40% less energy, and meet the criteria for those community design standards. So my contractor redesigned my system and submitted for permit. At the time permit submission was made, we were then informed that my property is on a corner lot. We were informed that the front of my house was not the front of my house. The side of my house was the front of my house, and therefore I had no rear, which essentially meant that I didn't have a rear-facing lot line on my property at all, which completely precluded me from being able to meet this prescriptive path. so committed to renewable energy, I contacted the Historic Design Review to discuss my what I feel is a very modest system of 6 panels on the back of my roof, just to see, you know, what the cost was and, you know, the process, et cetera, which is a several-month process. After some dialogue, I was informed that half of my roof was completely ineligible for solar panels due to, let me get the quote here, too visible from the street to warrant approval. And again, this is on the back of my house. So at that point, I tried to be a little creative and just talk to the building department, you know, appeal to them to see if I could get a zoning variance that would basically recognize my historic front yard line as my front so that I could meet these prescriptive measures, and that was outright denied as well. And I'm here today because I'm not the only Conservation District resident going through this, and we have made several attempts to work with the City of Portland to see if we can resolve this, which is outlined in my written testimony, so I won't get into that. But I just want to leave you with 5 main points. 1, conservation districts are not on the National Register of Historic Places. The minimum requirement from the survey data of these areas is a collection of 400 homes, with 26% being of significant value. So it's, from the data, it's a relatively low threshold. The zoning code does not specifically say that solar can't be installed in these areas, even street-facing installations like Anna had discussed. They only offer these 2 options, a prescriptive path or a historic design review, and 1% of the people in my neighborhood can actually meet this prescriptive path. So it's really not an option. Also, I just want to point out that the zoning code seems to me to unfairly restrict solar in particular in these areas, which is actually a removable item. It's not impacting the actual structure or the exterior skin of the building. It's reversible, or the reversibility concept. And permanent, this has already been mentioned, but, you know, permanent installations, vinyl siding, metal roofs, all these other things are actually allowable. And in addition, you know, any kind of utilities, wiring, et cetera, is also allowable. And in my testimony, you'll see a photograph that as of January 2011, wind turbines roof-mounted are allowable in conservation districts. There's one block from my house. So thank you for taking the time to listen to what is happening on the roofs in Portland. I believe Oregon has always been a leader in intelligent, sustainable design and also preserving its heritage. So neighborhoods all over the state have a collection of homes that meet this minimum threshold of, you know, a quarter of them being contributing a small collection of properties. So I am hopeful that legislation can be approved that will preclude other Oregonians from experiencing what my family did last year. And I'll just leave you with one anecdote. I have a young child, and just before canceling my contract, it was around the holidays, she said, "Mommy, I know you want solar panels for Christmas." She goes, "You can ask Santa, but I don't think you'll get them." Thank you.
Well, Representative Santa Claus, I think we'll ask the next.
Thanks.
Pam, we're happy you're here for round 2, so please.
Pam Hardy here on behalf of Thousand Friends of Oregon. I'm here to register our support for this bill. The time has come for solar, and land use laws should not stand in the way of rooftop solar of any kind. So I do hope that you pass this bill. It's a fantastic idea, and the testimony we've heard so far only goes to support that.
Thank you. Now, Clifford, this is the one you came for, right?
Yes, sir.
All right, here we go.
Chairman Gilliam.
Either way.
And members of the committee. My heart was breaking listening to my friend on the other end of the table. I thought that was mainly reserved for us solar engineers that go in and sit at the city and go through this process over and over again in different municipalities and counties. I'm a solar installer in the state.
And one more time for the record, please.
Clifford Schrock.
Thank you.
Yes. I'm a solar installer in Oregon. I work for a large electrical contractor, AC company, and I'm also on the board of Solar Oregon, which is kind of the training body in the state showing people about residential and commercial solar and trying to convince them how easy it is. I want to express my support for the intent of House Bill 3516, but notice I use the word intent. I mean, we want to simplify our process. It just has disappointed me that a common sense approach, I hate to strip away the power from the cities and the municipalities to make these kind of decisions themselves, but obviously I think it's come to the point that we have to override them and say, use some common sense here. I don't see solar panels or skylights or doing a new roof as being a whole lot different, and certainly we're doing everything in our power at this point in history to encourage renewable energy and to make the transition to renewable as painless as possible. And secondly, I realize it might be out of order, but I've also brought a letter from the Solar Oregon organization. We voted on it, and it's a letter of support for the Bill 3516. Thank you very much.
You bet. No, we're happy to have that for a record, and it's been distributed, so thank you. Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much. We've got just a few more folks, so we wanted to keep moving. Peggy Moretti, Chris Fick, and Glenn Montgomery. With all this information about the city of Portland, it's unfortunate they didn't I'll get you up here, so don't worry. Please start.
Do you guys want me to go?
Go ahead.
For the record, Glenn Montgomery with Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 3516. As Mr. Schrock has already stated, this is a common sense bill. We need to inject a little common sense into the permitting process. And this is one of those areas where throughout the city of Portland, my members and their prospective customers are struggling with this issue, trying to do the right thing and being obstructed and requiring onerous reviews and fees on top of what they're already paying to produce that renewable energy. So, you know, it supports our commitment as a state to renewable energy. It's a streamlining bill. It does avoid unnecessary land use provisions and reviews. And one other thing that I'd like to mention is that within the last year, Oregon became the first state to establish an installation code for solar. It's a statewide code, first in the nation. And the intent behind that code was to create greater consistency across jurisdictions. One of the challenges developers have is going from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. There are different rules. Makes it very difficult for them to keep track of what's going on from place to place and to follow those rules. So the state specialty code was established to create some guidelines and standards so the jurisdictions had some means of figuring out how do we permit solar. A lot of the jurisdictions were really struggling with that. So this was a great multi-stakeholder effort to put some standardization in process and to bring some consistency to the table. Having said that, it still provides local control at the jurisdictional level, but at least it gives them some best practices and guidelines to follow. And I think that's important, and I think this bill helps support that consistency. Lastly, I would ask that you consider an amendment. The bill right now, as it's stated, is only in favor of solar photovoltaic. I would ask you to include solar thermal. There's no reason why we can't be looking at hot water and space heating in addition to electricity generation. I don't think it was the intent of the authors of this bill to exclude it, and it makes sense for us to amend the bill to include solar thermal. And with that, I thank you for listening.
Hi. I'm Peggy Moretti. I'm the executive director of the Historic Preservation League of Oregon. We're a statewide nonprofit that is obviously very interested in preserving and passing forward the historic resources of Oregon. And I thank you very much for your time and attention today. I'm here to, I have submitted written testimony, which hopefully is in your packet, and on at the bottom of that there are some photographic illustrations of the point I want to make. And when I signed in today, I really hesitated. I checked, am I opposed to this bill, because I'm really not, my organization is not opposed to the bill, except that we would like to have an amendment put in place that does give consideration to the protection of historic properties and historic districts in the state. I think everybody's talked a great deal about common sense here today, and we couldn't be more supportive of making it easier and simpler and less expensive to use solar energy and other alternative energy sources. But I think this might be a situation where there could be some unintended negative consequences when it comes to historic districts and historic properties. And I would urge an amendment that does allow for local review of design review with National Register listed and local landmark listed individual properties as well as historic districts. And we say that for several reasons, not because we want to be elitist in any way or create extra work, but these are really significant economic and cultural assets in our state. And a historic district has gone through a public process. The residents of that district opted in to this effort, and it is seen as the integrity of the whole is a very important aspect of that. So it seems like a very reasonable idea to amend the legislation to allow local review of these historic properties. This represents a very, very small percent of the total properties in the state that would be applying for this. And the possibilities, as you look at the back of my testimony, of seeing these kind of alien appendages on the fronts of historic properties and multiply that across an entire district, it could have a very, very significant negative impact. So, again, I think hopefully the local design review would end up saying, yeah, please put your solar panels outside of the main public view. And I think that's a pretty reasonable and common sense approach to that type of situation. So we just would encourage you to make that amendment to the bill to allow there to be local review of the historic resources installations.
Thank you. Mr. Fick from the League.
Good afternoon. For the record, Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. The League is an association of all 242 cities in the state. And I'd be remiss if I didn't thank the chief sponsor, Representative Cannon and Christy Split, and Lisa Nato and Mark Pingelli for their willingness to work with us on this bill. Since we saw it in draft form, they've been willing to make numerous amendments to the process, and we're very thankful for that. And we think that it's close to something that we can support, but it's not quite there yet. Like Peggy, our concerns revolve around how historic and conservation districts would be treated under the legislation that's currently written. In the state of Oregon, there are currently 110 National Registered Historic Places, historic districts, and conservation districts are a couple dozen more. These areas comprise a very small percentage of a city's landscape. In the city of Portland, the buildings comprise about 2.8% of commercial and residential buildings. Conservation districts comprise another 1.6%. In Albany, it's 3%. In Oregon City, it's 4%. So we're talking about a very narrow scope of houses that would be subject to the design review process that you've talked about. Others like Peggy can testify in greater depth and with greater knowledge about the importance of these districts, but from the League's perspective, cities have carefully designated certain areas as being worth cultural and historic preservation. We think that those decisions, should be respected. Homeowners that buy in these districts should be aware of the benefits and the consequences that come with such ownership. Design review process for significant construction is one of those elements. It's important to know that the historic design review process, is this going in and out, or is it just me? Okay. is not particularly financially burdensome. The state's Historic Preservation Office surveyed 24 different communities about these fees. 11 of those local governments that responded didn't charge a single dime. Others charged between $38 and $400. The city of Hillsborough tried to recover 50% of the costs they incurred, and the city of Portland tried to recover all of the costs that they incurred. As you know, most building and planning departments operate on a fee-for-service basis. We don't rely on a lot of general fund revenue, so it's important for development seeks to pay for itself, and we're not subsidizing other fees. We're not using other fees to subsidize other sources of permitting. It's also worth noting that the design review process is only required in historic districts that I spoke of for street-facing installations that were visible from the public right-of-way. So essentially what we're asking for is half of the roof area and less than 5% of the cities and less than 5% of the buildings on less than 40% of the cities continue to be subject to a design review process. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a quick comment to Peggy and to Glenn. I appreciate your amendment suggestions, and I certainly don't speak, and they would agree with this wholeheartedly. I don't speak for the sponsors of this bill, but I am sure they're very sensitive to the historic nature of this, and so I will be interested in some more discussions on that. And the only difficulty, and I like the idea, is, of course, the old relating clause, so we'll have to take a closer look at that. But I appreciate both. Yeah.
Can I ask a question? Sure, thank you. Peggy, do you draw a distinction between historic districts and conservation districts? The federal designation versus the local designation?
I would certainly say I care more about the historic districts. Because the officially designated historic districts, I would I very much appreciate the frustration that a couple of the other testifiers have dealt with. So we do make a distinction. But, I mean, I still think the conservation districts have been designated as such for a reason.
A question for Mr. Fick. Thanks for your testimony as well and your help with the bill. Skylights, wind turbines, new roofs, do these also trigger design reviews, or is it in fact the case that for some reason solar is being singled out where other adjustments to the historical character of the building are not?
I would leave that question for the city of Portland is going to testify later. There are only a handful of these conservation districts that I'm aware of, and I think every city would probably have a different policy about what would trigger a design review in those districts because there aren't very many of them.
Great.
So I'll defer. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you all for testifying. And now our friends from the city of Portland, Daniel Eisenbeiss and Tim Heron.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Daniel Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland. With me here today is Tim Heron from the City's Bureau of Development Services. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this bill, and I would also extend our gratitude to Co-Chair Cannon's office and the proponents of this bill for engaging city staff in discussions about the intent of the bill. Written testimony is being handed out to you, which is accompanied by a letter from the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission as well, which is an appointed body of citizens that provides advice to the city for managing our conservation and historic districts. I'll only hit some of the highlights of the written testimony, but do want to note that the city of Portland has both historic districts and landmarks that relate to national standards, and we have conservation landmarks and conservation districts. The easiest way to think of these landmarks and districts essentially is as locally designated historic resources. These districts have support from the community by and large, and though the city strongly supports siting of solar installations, we also know that there's an expectation from Portlanders that we ensure that the historic resources in conservation districts and in historic districts are protected, and design review is an important tool for making sure that additions and new structures do not undermine the historic qualities of those districts. And Mr. Herron can speak more to some of the details of the way that that relates to some of the additions that have been mentioned by others today. As OSEA noted, we would also note that the legislation as it's currently crafted does not apply to all solar photovoltaic systems. So in that regard, it creates sort of different sets of standards at the state level. That's something that we would certainly have concern about as part of our zoning code amendments last year. The changes that were put in place apply to both photovoltaic systems as well as solar hot water systems. A couple of the changes that we made that might be of interest to the committee are that small-scale energy production is an allowed accessory use in all zones, and that the solar energy systems can actually exceed the height of structures in many areas within the city in certain zones, however not in historic districts. So I would say that while we don't support a blanket exemption from local review, design review for solar installations, we do support defining solar energy systems as an allowed use in all zones, and we know that has not occurred in some other jurisdictions. But we believe that it's a proper role for the city of Portland and for other cities to ensure that certain design, life safety, and construction standards are met when these systems are installed, and that their installation is consistent with local guidelines when there's an installation in a district with historic resources. So we would ask that you consider amendments to ensure that cities can continue with that. I'll simply offer the city's willingness to work with the committee and other stakeholders in this process to address some of these concerns and clarify the intent of the bill. I'd like to let Mr. Herron speak to some of the questions that have been raised, and we'd be happy to address any other questions the committee may have. Thank you.
Please identify.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, representatives. Getting my procedural down, so pleasure to be here today. I drove through a tornado to get down here, if you didn't read the note. I can speak to a couple points that were raised today, and actually have communicated with a couple of the people in the audience that have testified today via email. Unfortunately, I think I may be the Grinch when it comes to Kathleen's project around Christmas time. I worked with the Historic Landmarks Commission for about a year and a half during the RECAP 5 project when we went through and looked at regulations for solar panels and looking at several other amenities to open up the zoning code, as it may not seem to you today, to allow many other types of green technologies to exist in different parts of the city, including historic districts and including conservation districts as well. To hit on a couple comments, yes, it is true, skylights, satellite dishes, and certain types of siding are allowed by right. You can do that. They are have very, very prescriptive on their locations. They are all also not typically the size and as visible and as non-historic looking as photovoltaic panels are when they're mounted on rooftops of houses in these districts, both historic and conservation districts. The issue when we looked at this in RECAP 5 was to allow these to occur in the readily possible places least visible from the street to preserve that architectural character, which is also a cultural amenity within these historic districts. The issue on conservation districts versus historic districts, I'd agree that conservation districts do not have as strong as regulations as they do it as in historic districts. However, we recently saw what happens with these districts is they do become historic districts, and one of the reasons that conservation district overlay is on them is they do preserve that potential for them to be upgraded, if you will, to that larger, higher historic status. The district I'm speaking of is Irvington, which is now a historic district. It once was a conservation district of 1,500 properties. It's now a historic district of 3,000 properties. All told, these conservation districts and historic districts take up approximately 4.4% of the city. So we felt that it was reasonable that these districts have these increased restrictions. On the topic of fees, I heard this come around, and I've handled a lot of these personally. In no way have we asked someone to pay the required minimum fee and then tell them no. We've had a conversation with them about the project, about what can work. That often led to situations where the project might have needed to be downsized, and we made and gave that advice to them on the front end before they made an application for the city. I think I've hit most of the comments I made notes of, but of course I'm very happy to answer any others.
See if there are any questions from the committee. Representative Boone.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm signed on to this bill because I believe in pretty much all renewable energy opportunities. I never considered the historic piece of it. My house is probably 110, 120 years old, and we have a skylight on it, and it in no way would have been there in those days. But I'm kind of glad I live out in the country where we want to put up a PV panel. We probably could. Nobody's going to say anything. But
we envy you.
Sorry?
Sometimes we envy you.
Yeah.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The concept interests me because, for example, one might put the solar panels on for, let's say, a period of 20 years and then remove them. And so the historical nature is not hurt. Those who drive by during the 20-year period would be unhappy and upset, I suppose, and those that live nearby would be unhappy and upset. But so what is it that, is it your thought that we're protecting the expectations of those that live in the surrounding area, the folks that drive through? What are we about taking the position that we need not to modify the looks of those in the historic district? I'm trying to figure out what it is that we're protecting.
Okay. Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Bentz, I appreciate the question. I would say yes to all the above. What we're protecting is the value of that district, both as it's perceived as you go through it, so you know that you're in that district, but also as you're there as a homeowner and understanding and appreciating what are the values that make that property historic. The PV arrays, including the solar water, are inherently non-historic. By nature of some of their materials and their technology, which is why it's not that they're disallowed in these districts. And so we ask for the opportunity to regulate them, to place them in locations that are least visible from that public corridor and from that public right-of-way.
Oh, thank you. And this builds on the Chair's earlier remark about the question of degree, whether it's the, because I assume that at some point the shingles will be the solar panels. And so I guess we need to know how refined one gets in this effort. And so you could give some hope to those who might at some point be able to become more self-sufficient.
Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Bentz, I agree, and I do believe in hope. I think some of the regulations that we have in place are actually pushing the technologies for very well-integrated solar panel shingles. And they have a design and a style and a dimension that makes them imperceptible from other materials. Now, that wouldn't necessarily fall in the same suit in historic districts where we actually value that actual material, like a wood window. Is a poor substitute for a metal window, so that cultural material. But in conservation districts, there's definitely more opportunity to do that, have that kind of flexibility, and to see that technology come along. I know right now, solar shingles tend to not be as cost effective as the rack mounted style panels.
One final follow-up.
Final follow-up.
So it's a question of reality versus perception. Is that what you're saying? We have to have the wood window. It's not enough that it simply looks like one. Is that what you're saying? Because that suggests we'd have to go in, I guess, and look at the regulations folks relied upon in moving there. But if they see what they perceive to be a shingle, turns out to be a solar panel, does it matter?
Co-Chair Cannon and Representative Bentz, I think that it's a plausible point. Again, there is a distinction between historic districts where where that material is a cultural resource, that is a material that needs to be maintained or restored in that capacity. To the degree that we start building in fake substitutes, I think over time you do lose the integrity of that historic character. I think there's more flexibility in conservation districts, absolutely.
I have a comment, and you might want to respond. I personally have no particular interest in being acting as a local land use planning entity and trying to take on the question of what constitutes, the character, the essential character of a historic district or a conservation district. I don't think that's what we're sent here to do, and I really do prefer to allow that to be done at the local level. I think the frustration that brought this bill, or that part of this bill, and there's several parts, and I think you're supportive of the first, but the frustration that brought it has to do in part with what appears to be inconsistency. And I've heard wind turbines, skylights, satellite dishes, siding, and those don't trigger, it's probably a little more complicated than this, but at least in a number of instances, those things somehow are in keeping with the historic character of these conservation districts, but a photovoltaic array on a rooftop that doesn't exceed the roof height, and you've seen the -1 amendments, which clarify that we're not talking about separate structures, we're only talking about rooftop PV that doesn't exceed the highest point on that roof slope, somehow those are out of character. So I think it's the inconsistency that drives the frustration that brings the bill here.
Chair Cannon, I would suggest that perhaps there's much more consistency than appears based on some of the comments that have been made, and we'd be happy to follow up with you to provide more information about exactly how the city regulates some of those additions to existing structures that have been mentioned, if that would be helpful.
I would appreciate that.
Yeah, and Co-Chair, can I hit that right now? The wind turbines are not allowed in the residential portions of this district. The wind turbines referenced by one of those testifying today is in a commercial zone along a commercial corridor. It actually met the standards for setbacks. Again, that was something we did in the prescriptive standards to try and allow these small-scale renewable technologies to go through without that review process. I know them myself. They're pretty visible. I think it's a standard that we should have been tighter on, to be frank, but there they are. And I think in the mind of the general public not being aware of where some of the zoning boundaries fall and why on one side of the line means different regulations to another side of the line, I appreciate that frustration. But I would also argue that there is consistency.
Great. Well, I'll look forward to following up more on that. If there is nothing further, I will close the public hearing on 3516. I'll open a work session, and I have Representative Gilliam's permission to do this, on 2876, but only for the purpose of carrying. I probably didn't even need to open the work session in order to carry it over. Maybe I didn't have his permission to open it, but there we are. We're carrying over the work session on 2876, closing that work session. And members, on that bill, 2876, I would encourage you to look at the fiscal. Essentially, this has a subsequent to Ways and Means. It will be our decision on whether or not to forward this bill that, frankly, with a $250,000 fiscal, I think will struggle to make it through the Ways and Means process, but it's a discussion we can have about whether to send it there in the first place. With that, I will close the Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water.